Fellows unequivocally told the inquest that he was on holiday for the entire period before and after Diana's death and did not return to work until after her funeral. Now let's move to January 2011 and the publication of the diary of Tony Blair's press secretary, Alastair Campbell. 31st August. At about 4 a.m, I got a flavour of the royal establishment's approach when I had a conference call with Robert Fellows. You know about Diana, do you? She's dead. It was all very matter-of-fact. 1st of September, meeting at the Lord Chamberlain's office, attended by Robert Fellows. 2nd of September, 10 a.m, Fellows and I had a discussion. 3rd of September, Fellows called early. 4th of September, I had another discussion with Fellows. 5th of September, Fellows said we had all worked well together. Far from being on holiday, as he had claimed under oath, Fellows was at the very centre of Diana's funeral arrangements, overseeing her burial throughout the week. Fellows was the man that Diana had described to friends as one of the three names that I fear. He hates me. He will do anything to get me out of the royals. Sir Robert Fellows was made a lord in 1998.
There's a quote from Prince Philip. In the event that I am reincarnated, I would like to return as a deadly virus in order to contribute something to solve overpopulation.
This little boy is called Philip. His full name is Philip Schleswig Holstein Sonderberg Glucksberg, and he grew up in Germany. He was raised amongst his Nazi in-laws, some of whom later became high-ranking members of the SS. His Nazi relatives then sent him to this school in southern Germany, where he studied for a while under the Nazi curriculum. Philip later recalled that there was much heel-clicking and shouts of Heil Hitler were compulsory. And here's Philip, in Darmstadt, in the heart of Germany, in November 1937, attending a family funeral for some of his Nazi in-laws. Marching in front of a Sieg Heiling crowd, this is Philip, next to Christoph, his SS brother-in-law, and Philip, his Nazi stormtrooper brother-in-law. Imagine if a man with a past like this had somehow ended up marrying into British aristocracy. Well, he did.
And as we know,
he got first prize. He became the Duke of Edinburgh, also known as Prince Philip, after marrying Princess Elizabeth, the future Queen of England.
British lawyers have warned us of 87 legal issues concerning this film. Several of those warnings concern the following interview.
And this is with Oliver James, a clinical psychologist.
I think Prince Philip is somebody who is devoid of any internal sense of right and wrong. So deep down, he cares nothing about anybody else. He regards everybody else as potentially a threat. He is completely selfish. And that is very like Fred West or any other psychopathic individual.
Oliver James is one of Britain's leading clinical psychologists. Yet lawyers told us that we could not include his professional diagnosis of Prince Philip in this film. So we looked for the current medical definition of psychopathy and discovered that most psychopaths are not convicted criminals but function normally in society. We also found that psychopaths tend to gravitate towards highly paid professions, such as the legal profession and, oh dear, us, filmmakers. Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip have traditionally been presented to the public as role models for the rest of society. But why?
Noel Botham.
Certainly. I mean, Philip's been in half the beds of England, including two of his wife's close family. But,
Who?
Do you want me to say that?
Or yes, go on.
Princess Margaret and Princess Alexander.
Stop it.
Oliver James.
I don't think that she was somebody who was a kind of would have wanted to marry a psychopath. I think she must have got a very nasty shock when she found out quite how unpleasant he is. But obviously, being the sort of person she is, she said, well, that's it. You know, I've got to stick with this and he's going to shag anything that moves and I can't do anything about that. That's what they all do anyway, isn't it?
Almost everyone has heard rumours about Prince Philip's innumerable extramarital affairs. Yet newspapers have never published full reports, whereas they routinely expose the affairs of pop stars, footballers and other celebrities. Why? Because in Britain, the media dare not challenge the authority of those at the very top.
Oliver James.
I have a friend of mine who was at a party where he had to observe the disgusting sight of Prince Philip wearing a leather jacket, dancing to a Stones song with his hand halfway up the skirt of some young woman. And that's not an unusual event at all for Prince Philip. He's done that sort of thing many times.
This isn't a question of morality. It's a question of media cowardice. The British press usually love nothing more than exposing the peccadilloes of eminent people. all except senior members of the royal family who are mysteriously exempt. Funny, that. You may think that we should have given Prince Philip a right of reply in this film. Well, we did, but he declined our invitation, as did the entire royal family. And they are not the only ones. In fact, if you're wondering why you're not hearing from any members of the British establishment in this film, it's certainly not for want of trying on our part. We asked all of these pillars of the establishment to take part, and they all refused. I wonder why.
The White Fiat Uno.
What you are seeing is what the CCTV camera at the entrance to the Alma Tunnel was recording at the time of the crash. Nothing. Because it was switched off, even though it was usually switched on 24 hours a day. Was that just another coincidence? Or something more sinister? Even though no cameras recorded the crash, it is beyond doubt that a white Fiat Uno collided with Dodie and Diana's car in the tunnel and contributed to their deaths. The French police tried to deny its existence at first, but too many eyewitnesses saw it, and paintwork from a white Fiat Uno was found on the Mercedes where the two cars had collided. So, who was driving it? Suspicions fell on James Anderson, a photographer with connections to the Secret Services. He had been following Dodie and Diana earlier in the month during their holiday in the Mediterranean, but he was not amongst the paparazzi who were waiting outside the Paris Ritz on the night of the crash.
Noel Botham, author of The Murder of Princess Diana.
Anderson was a millionaire paparazzo, a very well-known member of the paparazzi on the continent, made a great deal of money out of royal pictures, lived in some style in the French countryside.
He told police that he wasn't in Paris on the night of the crash, but gave two completely different accounts of where he had been. His wife and son also gave him contradictory alibis. Privately, he told friends that he had been there in the tunnel in Paris that night. Crucially, Anderson owned a white Fiat Uno.
Brian Basham, writer.
It was said of this Fiat Uno that it was up on chocks and didn't work. Well, that appears to be untrue, too. It was driven many hundreds of miles around the French countryside. So the whole question of the Fiat Uno and who was driving it, which is, of course, absolutely crucial, totally crucial to the investigation, has never been resolved. And you have to say, why?
In May 2000, Anderson's body was found in a blazing car in woodland near Montpellier.
In a Ministry of Defence field, shooting range field, in a car which had burned out and locked, but no keys were in the car or in his pocket. And the police claimed he committed suicide.
They claimed this, even though the fireman who found him says he saw two bullet holes in Anderson's skull. You don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to point out that it's difficult for a man to shoot himself twice in the head and then set fire to his own car before dying.
I would like a monarchy that has more contact with its people.
By the end of the inquest, so much suspicious evidence had been heard that the establishment coroner could take no chances. So he prevented the jury even considering murder as an option. His summing up lasted almost 3 days, during which he continually distorted the evidence, ignored much of the eyewitness evidence, and tried to convince the jury that the crash was nothing more than an accident.
At the start, I told you it was not necessary to solve every subplot in the story.
There are certain matters relating to Henri Paul that simply cannot be resolved with any clarity.
You've not heard in person from Professor Lecomte, Dr. Pepin and others concerned with the analysis of Henri Paul's sample.
In common with most road traffic accidents, this collision did not appear to have a single cause.
The relationship between Diana and Dodie had reached the point where it could no longer be tolerated.
The conspiracy theory has been minutely examined and shown to be without any substance.
Will you please now retire to consider your verdicts?
But the one thing the establishment and the royal courts couldn't fix was the jury. 11 ordinary men and women who ignored the coroner's one-sided summing up and instead spent almost a week examining the evidence for themselves.
Richard Wiseman, diary entry. It's day 93 and we're still waiting for the verdict. Nobody around me can understand why the jury are taking so long. The Hacksaw expected a verdict of accidental death to be returned within seconds.
Oh. Did you see those sandwiches they just took in for the jury? Yeah, I mean, my worry is they look far too good. You know, if they'd given them some curled up, you know, they'd agree by two, give the verdict by three, and be home by four.
Fact is, it's becoming painfully obvious that the jury, unlike the press, bothered to listen to the evidence, and they are now analysing it very, very carefully.
A year after the inquest into the deaths of Princess Diana and Dodi Al-Fayed, we asked a cross-section of ordinary people what the jury's verdict was.
Accidental death.
Purely an accident.
It was accident.
Was it accidental?
Accidental death.
It was an accident.
Accidental death, I believe.
It was an actual accident.
Accidental death.
Accidental death.
The answers the public gave us were uniformly inaccurate.
They said the paparazzi, didn't they?
The paparazzi chasing her?
I think, yes, it was from the paparazzi.
Around the world, people have been massively misled by the British media into believing that the deaths were an accident caused by the paparazzi. But in reality, the jury did not blame the paparazzi, and they decided that the crash was not a mere accident, but something much more serious.
Day 94, 4:07 p.m.
In the end, the jury delivered the most powerful verdict that the coroner had left open to them. Unlawful killing is defined in law as homicide or manslaughter, and the jury blamed the following vehicles, not the paparazzi.
Michael Mansfield, QC.
What is also interesting, overlooked, I think, almost totally by the media and commentators, was the wording of the verdict. Well, the detail of this verdict was such that it was an unlawful killing contributed to by, and one of the factors was, following vehicles, not the paparazzi.
Initially, journalists were confused, but within minutes, the BBC was reporting that the jury had blamed the paparazzi, and the rest of the media followed the example of the British establishment's impartial broadcaster. Soon, the verdict had been spun by the media into an accident caused by the paparazzi. And so,
a lie
got halfway around the world while the truth was still putting its boots on. The altered verdict was still on the BBC's news website at the time of making this documentary.
Whether it was a case that the commentators, in the end, wanted it to be the paparazzi, and so immediately assumed that, and hadn't, and often some of them didn't really follow it on a daily basis. They might read in the odd transcript. And certainly a change of that kind, which was very important because following vehicles was a much bigger category than just paparazzi because of the reasons I've just given, that nobody either wanted to understand what that meant, or if they did, weren't prepared to include it in their commentaries.
The media declared that Mohammed Al-Fayed had been defeated. But in reality, the jury's verdict supported what he'd been saying all along. Diana and Dodi were unlawfully killed. 2011. And the British media, after seriously misreporting the verdict, refuse even to discuss what the verdict really means. Their deafening silence speaks volumes about the deeply troubling outcome.
Oliver James.
There was a feeling of openness about it. And yet, at the end of it, I have to say, even as a supposedly educated scientific person, I would still say I don't feel at all confident that it got to the bottom of it.
Laurie Taylor.
People will still go on thinking there is something happening here because they know the British establishment. They know their capacity for cover-ups. The newspapers in this country really don't want to upset the very top.
Lauren Booth.
The most bizarre thing is that normal people in this country who don't necessarily enjoy conspiracy theories, if you go to a bar, you'll find three people who go, ooh, but the royals did it, didn't they?
Piers Morgan.
I think most of the British public still believe it was dodgy. I believe Mohammed Al-Fayed will always believe it's dodgy. I believe the establishment want it all to just go away for whatever reason, and I don't know the answers to these questions. All I know is that the inquest has probably raised more questions than in the end it answered, and it answered a lot of questions.
Oliver James.
I would still say it was fantastically convenient for the monarchy that this woman died. Just think what she might be saying now if she hadn't died. Think what a problem it would have created for Camilla. Think of, you know, it would have created serious constitutional problems that even she was perfectly capable of being somebody who started a movement to end the monarchy.
The full facts about the Alma Tunnel crash may never be known, but we do know this for certain. Dodie and Diana were the victims of an unlawful killing, and various parts of the establishment, with their unerring instinct for mutual self-preservation, then seemed to have rallied around to cover it up. They covered for each other and suppressed uncomfortable facts, and they think that they have got away with it. The British establishment think that they have got away with murder. But then what's new? They've been getting away with murder for centuries. Since the crash, some curious things have happened. Charles has married Camilla, as he'd always wanted to. MI6 now publicly admit that they have been involved in killings. Diana has been airbrushed out of official royal history. No action has been taken against the police chiefs who suppressed Diana's sworn statement predicting that the royal family would kill her in a car crash. Instead, they both now sit in the House of Lords. Mohammed Al-Fayed was ordered by Prince Philip to take down the royal warrants that had hung for decades outside Harrods. And shortly before selling the store in 2010, and more in sorrow than in anger, he symbolically burned them in sight of his son's grave.
I am destroying this royal crest as a tribute to my son, Dodi. I feel that he is looking down on this today. There was a clear verdict of unlawful killing. So why has nobody been arrested? What is at the core of all this is racism. Powerful people in this country, my country, don't want to hear me talking about Prince Philip's Nazi background, but I have to, because it's just 100% true. They wouldn't accept me or my son. And when he fell in love with Diana, they murdered them.
Despite obtaining a verdict that vindicates his years of struggle, Mohammed Al-Fayed fights on. Still grieving for his son, he has opted for truth rather than happiness. Legal action is continuing in France against the police chiefs who suppressed vital evidence, and the establishment cover-up is being steadily exposed day by day. Truth will out. And as more and more people come to understand what the damning inquest verdict really means, we may soon witness what the British establishment fears most. The end of the monarchy.
Now we move across the Atlantic for more suppressed information. This is Dean Puckett interviewing Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed about an interview he had with whistleblower Sybil Edmonds. This is the third Crisis of Civilization podcast, and it was published in May 2013.
I'm Dean Puckett. I'm the director of the documentary The Crisis of Civilization, and you can find me and my other film work at deaddeanfilms.co.uk. I'm here today with Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed, the author of The User's Guide to the Crisis of Civilization and How to Save It. Our podcast today is going to focus on a new article that Nafees is writing about the FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds. Nafees, maybe you could just tell the listeners who Sybil Edmonds is and a little bit about her.
Sybil Edmonds is a former FBI translator who was contracted by the FBI to translate intelligence that they had been developing in the years prior to and up to 9/11. And she specializes in kind of in Persian, Turkish, Azerbaijani languages. And she got her job shortly, a couple of weeks after the 9/11 attacks, when the FBI was kind of obviously scrambling to develop a kind of big picture understanding of what the hell had happened, and had realised that their language capabilities were pretty dismal and they needed to bring new people in. So Sybil Edmonds began working for the FBI. I think it was late September she actually got the contract in 2001. And she worked with them for about 6 months or so, and then she ended up being fired And what subsequently emerged from all of this experience that she had at the FBI was a spate of quite shocking revelations about high-level corruption in the US national security system, starting at the lowest levels of the FBI in the Washington field office where she was working, going all the way up to the Pentagon, the US State Department, the CIA, the Justice Department, the US Cabinet, as well as congressmen from both parties. And it was a really, really entrenched web of corruption that she'd uncovered.
And in researching this article, you've had a long recorded Skype chat with her, which we'll cut to intermittently through the podcast.
So I'm recording now.
Okay.
You are the most gagged woman in American history. And I mean, arguably, probably the most gagged person, you know, in modern times. It's really amazing. What is it about what you discovered in this? Was it about 7 months, 9 months, or something? You were working for the FBI. What was it that you discovered that was so explosive that you brought the entire machinery of the US government on your head?
Let me start with my languages. My primary language is Turkish. The secondary language, it would be almost equal, is Farsi, the language spoken in Iran. And because of that, I'm also able to, not as a verbatim pro, but I understand a lot of Dari language. Dari language is about 80%. It's like a Persian Farsi dialect. Azerbaijani is because of my father's background, and of course English, because both I studied in English in Turkey, but then I came and I went to universities here. My degrees is very simple. I have two bachelor's degrees. I have one in criminal psychology, the other one in criminal justice from George Washington University. Yeah, you're right. They consider this classified. But then I got a master's degree in public policy, U.S. public policy from George Mason University. And my work background up until the work that I did with the FBI, I never worked for the government. I did some volunteer work for the criminal justice system in Virginia, for juvenile court in Alexandria. I dealt with sexually abused children. And other than that, it's been private business. I traveled extensively until 2000. I had one job temporarily in Russia right after the fall of the Soviet Union, 1992, 1993, with Rostropovich Foundation, which dealt with children hospitals in back then Leningrad, St. Petersburg. Now, with the FBI, I want to emphasize, like, I did not discover anything by myself.
Yeah.
These investigations, operations were ongoing since 1996 and not through one field office. That was where I work, FBI Washington, D.C. field office, but also FBI field offices elsewhere, especially specifically in Chicago. And these discoveries and all the suspicions of some of the activities that later through investigation produced explosive results were being carried out long before I joined the FBI. But what happened was, since it was right after 9/11, and since these different field offices and different operations being separated both through bureaucracy, but also intentionally, for example, FBI, Turkish counterintelligence could not talk with or share information with FBI Turkish Criminal Division. And the FBI Criminal Division could not share information and work together with FBI Turkish Counterterrorism Division, because of these separations, that a lot of it was intentional, some of it was due to bureaucracy. So what happened was, I came in there, and I will get into it really more in detail, because it really needs to be explained how and what operations we are talking about. I ended up working, because I was the only language specialist, and up until after 9/11, 3 days after 9/11, FBI was not allowed to have an official Turkish division, whether it's counterintelligence, counterterrorism. They could carry out some monitoring under FISA and pursue some criminal investigations, but they could never have a division that is officially called Turkish division. They could never have a division that is called UK division, even though we had all the other European countries' division. We had a French division, which, you know, we monitored, when I say we, FBI analysts and translators, their embassy and attaché information, etc. Germany, we did. All, you know, South American countries, we did. Turkey, UK, and Belgium. Three countries, and to a certain extent, Azerbaijan.
Wow, so FBI was these four countries were
forbidden.
These four countries had, the FBI could not, was not allowed, essentially, to wiretap them. But they were.
Well, they did, but they were not given any power to pursue the results of any investigations. First of all, the divisions were not official. While the other, for example, FBI has a huge Israel division, okay? It's one of the biggest ones. You know, there's Iran and the Saudi Arabia and all the Arab-speaking nations. But then Israel has a huge division, okay? Yeah. Even though it's an official division, it has a name, the FBI Israel Counterintelligence Division, Israel Criminal Division. So they have it. They have the power to wiretap as well. But because of political reasons, FBI is always, almost 99.999%, they are forbidden, they are prevented from implementing further actions, whether it's going to courts on espionage cases or if it's criminal cases, that's due to political pressure.
Right.
Now, Turkey and UK and Belgium, the UK embassies cannot be tapped, okay? That is just a, but while you can tap completely the military attaché for, let's say, Turkey and the Turkish embassy and Turkish NGOs or Turkish lobby firms, since it is not recognized as official, and if you find incredible terrorism or espionage cases, you are in a really bad situation in terms of pursuing and doing something about it. Okay? Now, even though it's official for Israel division in the FBI, with them, with Israel, is the political pressure. Because, you know, once in a while we hear about, oh, certain wiretaps that came out and implicated a certain congresswoman on AIPAC. Well, AIPAC has known for a long time that they are being wiretapped. And they're so bold. They're like, they don't care because they know that people can't take action. They are prevented by the political powers. Because who is FBI answerable to? It's the executive branch and ultimately is answerable to the White House, okay? DOJ White House. And so while you have agents who are, let's say, within this Turkish division, they're working because they find explosive operations, you know, whether it's narcotics related or it's espionage related against Turkey. And they have actually channels to pursue it and bring these people in to justice, whether it's the U.S. counterparts or the Turkish criminals here in the United States through criminal prosecution channels. But then their hands are tied because you have the White House, which takes order from the CIA and the State Department, telling the top layer, maybe the top four or five guys. So all the agents I work with in the FBI, They were really good and they were doing their work, okay? They were good. They were really pursuing these true, real terrorism or criminal or espionage cases. Mm. The top layer answerable to the White House and influenceable completely by the State Department, the CIA, were the ones who were coming and saying, we are shutting down this investigation. Or I give one example that may illustrate it. Besides gathering and collecting information, the agents, also FBI agents, conducted field operations. Hmm. In one case, we had a Turkish target or targets several individuals under a certain operation. This one was done through Washington, D.C. field office agents. And these targets, we had information about how they were going to bring certain kilogram of heroin through what channel, and it was going to be somewhere in D.C., okay? Hmm. And the field operation, the FBI, and also DEA, this is Drug Enforcement Agency, also was included because this was a joint operation, right? So that morning at 9:15, this particular thing was going to take place. And the DEA agents and the FBI agents, they were having this field operation, and they were going to bust these guys. Okay? So they are actually in a van, several SUVs. This is the FBI agents, the DEA agents. And about 15, 20 minutes before the bust, the FBI headquarters, and this is the top, you know, SES level, senior executive level, they contact the field agents in the van and they say, you call it off. You turn around and you get the DEA agents off. This is called off. Now, agents are pissed. They are like, what? How could this be? I mean, we have all the stuff and we cannot give you any explanation. This is the two of the targets have diplomatic immunities. Well, we knew that they were not diplomats, okay? But FBI says, no, somebody in the top level FBI had shared that information with people in the State Department. Mm. So between the State Department and the White House, the director's office was being told to call off the operation. Turn around. You're not making this bust. This operation is terminated at this point, ASAP. Mm. You're returning back to the field office.
What, so when was this incident?
Well, this is one of many incidents. This particular incident took place in, it would be around end of October 2001. But again, the agents I work with, I mean, and with the files operations, not only on these particular guys, but other connected target guys, they have had similar things happening to them over and over and over since the beginning of this particular operation in 1996.
These targets were related to this particular operation. What was the investigation? What were these investigations about?
Well, this investigation, FBI's part was they were after these guys because they also had some operation centers in New Jersey, and they brought in, you know, heroin. And this, the source of heroin, I'm not going to go all the way to the original source, but from Turkey to Belgium, from Belgium into the United States.
Yeah.
And, well, let's say if you had four targets, foreign targets, okay, and let's say one of them had a green card but still had dual citizenship, and out of these four targets, two of them were directly connected to Pentagon and the military attaché of Turkey, but they didn't have diplomatic titles.
I see.
So you have a case where there are people who are working with Pentagon, NATO, and the Turkish military attaché who are bringing heroin into the United States. DEA knows about it, the good agents. The FBI knows about it. They want to go and make a bust because this guy doesn't have an official diplomatic cover. But yet, the State Department, aka CIA, and the White House, they tell that you terminate this operation.
Hmm.
Because what's going to happen? You arrest these guys, this thing comes out, their identities, who they are, the operations. Now you're implicating high-level Turkish military, NATO, and the United States operations military operators.
Hmm.
Can you imagine what would happen?
What you're saying is that one of the reasons it seems that this was blocked was because people inside the US government at a senior level actually condoned in some way this criminal activity, this heroin trafficking and all the rest of it. They were actually in some way involved, and they didn't want that involvement to come to light through this operation. Is that
not only that they were involved, they actually participated.
Yeah.
We had well-documented investigation cases that showed a lot of heroin entered the United States through a military plane that landed in Andrews Air Force Base. Okay, one of my whistleblowers, John Cole, he was one of the managers for the counterintelligence, okay, in FBI headquarters. Well, he tried to blow the whistle.
Wow.
Okay, so you have, it's not that, okay, they know, but because they are allies and they are having other use for us, the other way. No, that was not the case. It was, see, this is the whole thing. There is While I was, after I came back from Vietnam, there's a guy who was one of the top attorneys with the Justice Department, not the FBI. And he retired in 2005, 2006. He's not a whistleblower or anything, and he's like one of the system guy. And he said, you know what, Sabelle? That's one of the mistakes, I believe, the DOJ and the State Department, because the decision for the state secrets privilege didn't originate from the FBI. The DOJ implemented it, but the decision came from the State Department, CIA, that they needed to enforce state secrets privilege. My case had to be stopped from any, you know, proceeding in courts. But he said that was their biggest mistake because they panicked, okay? Hmm. But with what you know and what you could have taken out, even though you were not supposed to document-wise from the FBI, that if they let you just talk and take this stuff out there, nobody would have believed anyway.
Yeah.
So they actually made a big tactical mistake because they even gave more attention in some ways and legitimacy by saying, we cannot let her open her mouth. Yeah. You let her open her mouth. Well, if I had really gone to court and testified under oath, then I would have said something like, okay, here is a particular office in Pentagon, and here is a particular office in the State Department, and this is the division within NATO that which is part of it is the Turkish division of NATO, because Turkey is a NATO ally, and they're engaged in this, including Herod. Nobody would have believed me. It would have sounded insane.
The situations that you're describing here, when you go into detail in your book and you explain all of the various strands of investigations that you ended up translating intelligence in relation to, they really are just small facets of this web of criminal activity. On the one hand, some of it was just there was bureaucracy, and there was what you might expect in any organization. There's a lot of bureaucracy and blah blah blah, red tape. Then there were other layers. So the next layer that I thought was interesting was this kind of criminal negligence.
For example, let me start with three points, so that way everything will start maybe making more sense. You just mentioned translation, and I want to also clarify something else here. So let's say you are wiretapping or monitoring a military attaché, Turkish military attaché, and let's say embassy, right? Well, sure, there will be communications that are in Turkish between Turkish actors, targets, right? Some of them are non-targets who are just calling, and you by default hear it, and you know, you're the translator, you translate it. But I would say close to 40-50% of those communications didn't have to be translated because they were carried out in English, okay? So when wiretap brings this information to the FBI, it doesn't distinguish which ones are in English, which ones are in Turkish. Now, the targets may be Turkish or Pakistanis, but a lot of conversations are in English. One example of this would be there was a very heated period between summer 2001, and these are both archive and later live monitoring, where on daily basis we sat and listened to Paul Wolfowitz talking to the top military attaché guy, you know, Turkish military attaché, okay, on Iraq. This was before we invaded Iraq. And there were a lot of discussions. There was a lot of they were trying to get, and this is Paul Wolfowitz, the Turkish military, saying, this was actually plans on going and invading Iraq, and Turkey, in order to have U.S. use the base, etc., they had one condition, one important condition Turkey was putting there and demanding was like, you let us handle northern Iraq, you know, the whole Kirkuk region, because we have our own interests there with the Kurds and everything. Well, the plan was only United States and United Kingdom. And they said, well, you don't do that, we're not going to let you use our damn base. Hmm. And the middle guys, they're not the top guys, Wolfowitz, were trying to get this thing mild and saying, come on now, look, initially we will do it, but within the first few years, then we would let you to participate in some of the stuff, you know, with Iraq. But initially, we do not want to have that kind of a mess in the northern border. Well, so what I'm trying to say is all this conversation was in English. They didn't need a translator, but it came through the same cable, through the same wiretap. Hmm. So to hear almost on daily basis, Richard Pearl or Paul Wolfowitz talking to the highest level guy in Turkish embassy was a regular occurrence. And agents were able to directly listen to it too. And when you listen, I mean, so much you were finding out that was just mind-boggling. Now, the most troubling, the most important aspect of this case, the state secrets privilege, ended up tying directly to 9/11.
Yeah.
Because the previous, some of them, they were shut down. That's why I'm referring to as previous investigations. They were shut down by the end of 2001, early 2002. Investigations produced all these evidence, documented evidence in the FBI that made it very clear that we, the United States, up until 2001, including the time of, at the time of 9/11, we had very close joint operations with Ayman Zawahiri, with Bin Laden, not only one Bin Laden, several Bin Laden family members, including Osama Bin Laden, okay? We had meetings with them. Yeah. In Baku, in Azerbaijan, the U.S. Embassy in Azerbaijan in Baku.
When were those, when did those meetings take place?
So there were at least three or four meetings, two of them with Zawahiri. And we had actually from U.S. people going and attending that meeting in the U.S. Embassy, including people such as Prince Bandar was in there. We had several known Turkish figures. 1997, 1998, the last one being in late 1999 in Azerbaijan, in Baku, in U.S. Embassy.
And the Turkish figures, were they, those were military intelligence or government? Who were these people?
This was, well, one of them was the highest level Turkish general, that is the NATO, Turkish NATO general.
I see.
But also it included a very high level religious figure, which maybe we'll get into it later. This made the entire thing with 9/11 and what the government was saying completely moot.
So it's a massive, it's really a massive and complex web of things that she brings to the fore, which is why I think it's important that people actually read her book and understand how complex these things are, but also how ridiculously facile the picture is that is presented to us in the media about terrorism.
I've taken a lot of heat for saying it goes back to the Crusades.
Barely 100 years after Muhammad's death, the Islamic Empire had spread far and wide. The Pope reacted to the Muslim expansion by launching Christendom's version of holy wars, the Crusades.
And you can just see it happening again.
This kind of, quote, clash of civilizations.
And this could be a defining moment.
That the world needs to march forward.
To deal with the scourge of
the bearded ones.
And see what they have done against mankind.
Because it's only going to happen with all of us together.
The message to Muslim nations and moderate Arabs, Pakistan also, is...
We hold our beliefs every bit as strongly as they hold theirs. And now is the time to show it.
A huge lack of self-reflection about what went wrong with these systems and a projection outwards onto these bad guys. And it's all their fault and they're evil and they hate our freedoms.
Yeah.
Whereas what Sybil's getting into is actually how those bureaucracies work and function, the problems with them, the corruptions within them. But people don't, the mainstream doesn't really want to look at that. They prefer the simple narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, one of the things that came out when I was working on the story was the stuff that she brings out is so big. It's actually probably the biggest scandal that's ever happened in the United States, and yet it's happened under the radar with nobody really knowing about it. I mean, what, you know, we look at what's happening with Bradley Manning, which is absolutely atrocious. We look at what's happening with Julian Assange, and, you know, whatever we think of Julian Assange, you know, this is, it's not about the person, but let's look at the way in which we've seen WikiLeaks and whistleblowing being treated by the Obama administration. It's quite extraordinary. But all of the focus is on those things. But Sybil Edmonds, who is a whistleblower and presides over one of the most credible whistleblowing organizations in America, the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, and she has something like 70-odd former federal government officials who've worked in national security. Over the, you know, many of them are veterans who've worked across government, you know, for 10 years, 20 years. All of them basically with insane stories of what has gone on inside the US government and how they've been retaliated against. I mean, so the stuff that she's bringing out really is actually extraordinary, and to the extent that one of her FBI supervisors has actually described the scandal as bigger than Watergate.
How could it be? I mean, we went there in 1997, or was it 1998 during Clinton, and we bombed this pharmaceutical company. So it had to do with Bin Laden. Well, during that period, after that period, we actually officially were meeting with Bin Laden and Bin Laden's group, which was never referred to as Al-Qaeda. It was always still Mujahideen. And to have this documented evidence that was gathered through counterintelligence operations that targeted Turkey. Now, the same thing. They had counterintelligence operation, not my division, but there was a large, and this was an official Pakistan division. And to say, and yes, this guy was wanted for these particular bombings, we bombed, but yet you have all this evidence, hard evidence. And again, it was not that some CIA faction, they let Mujahideen do that. In fact, indirectly helped, none of that. We officially, in official capacity, we were meeting with these individuals, with this group, all the way till 2001.
You mentioned these, this Caucasus operation and the Central Asian operations. What, in your view, was the objective of these meetings? Were these part of a wider operation linked to these Mujahideen networks in these countries? Was this? I mean, you mentioned the Cold War, and how that, you know, the Cold War mindset has become even more entrenched in different ways. Was this part of that?
It was, but first, like in the early part of second half of 1990s, in 1997, 1998, some of these operations involved actually bringing a lot of people, and included Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Afghanistan into Turkey. They were trained at. Actually, their passports were changed. They were given Turkish passports. With NATO airplanes, they were taken to the operations that were being carried out. This was during all this Bosnia and Kosovo. And this was, again, official operations. It was not that, oh, these Mujahideens, they had their backpacks, and they found their ways through the borders, and they ended up in places like Albania. It's not. They came, and they came from Turkish, official NATO Turkish planes, into certain Eastern blocs in Europe, and that's how they were brought in there.
Yeah.
So in 1997, 1998, there was a lot of those were concentrated on bringing these people into that block, the Balkans, and there was some focus there with all the together operations carried out through our Chechen channel there.
Yeah. With
but then towards 1999, Azerbaijan became actually a hub that both included the stuff with heroin, but also it was organizing other smaller religious factions in other stands, in other countries like Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. And this was when Fethullah Gulen, which is his organization worth 20-some billion dollars, he's in the United States, his headquarters is in the United States, he's a Turkish, you know, religious figure. They opened more than 350 what they call madrasas. It's a different version of, it's not exactly the same madrasas the Wahhabis set up in Pakistan, but madrasas and mosques in all this country. Now, granted, in some of these countries that they were more siding with Russians, they kicked them out. They banned Gulens and all these madrasas. But many others, they didn't. So when that was happening, part of these madrasas, the religious schools as part of mosques, that's Gulen's movement together with the U.S., NATO, Turkey factions were setting up in these countries. They had this very strong English language department. If you look at it, I mean, this is not top secret.
Yeah.
If you look at it, they emphasize English language. So you would see hundreds of English teachers, Americans, with diplomatic passports going to these countries to work for Gulen's madrasas, teaching English in religious schools.
Yeah.
And would you give diplomatic passports, Americans going there teaching English in madrasas? It's mind-boggling. But again, these were all done through official, implemented, formal channels. These were not, U.S. saw that some mujahideens or some people, big people from Saudi Arabia were pouring money into this, and Turkish Gulen was doing that, and they said, you know what, this is to our advantage. Hey, this is a great thing. Be like that. That's not the case. The whole implementation planning, from the planning stage to the implementation, were all taking place here via State Department in Washington, D.C. It was fully being communicated with the Turkish arm of NATO people, whether in military attaché or other military-related organizations in the United States with offices in NATO. So this was not, again, our enemies is our friend. That was not the case. And yeah. I know it's being reflected. So if my case would have been allowed to proceed in courts, because I know the agents I worked with and I worked for, in fact, during closed meetings, some of these agents, they came and they told all this to these senators. They vouched for these reports, and they would have testified under oath. Or if the Congress would have deposed them, because initially Congress was going to have public hearings on my case. All these agents from the FBI, they would have told the truth because they were the good guys in this, FBI agents. But it didn't happen. The hearings were shut down because Congress was gagged in my case, because the CIA, the State Department, they didn't want that. The courts were shut down, and the media, initially during the first couple of years, some of these people, insiders, the agents from the FBI and even from some other agencies, including DEA, they were even willing to sit anonymously. I mean, they would be known to the reporters like New York Times, Washington Post, talk to them, but as long as their names were kept off the record, anonymously, they were cited. Not a single one of those meetings and what they gave these reporters were printed.
Yeah.
And after that, they knew you can't get this information out even if you wanted to.
Why is there this block on these issues which are so significant and critical to U.S. national security and what happened in 9/11, why was there this strange and bizarre reluctance, and not just reluctance, but this active opposition to investigating these things, and in fact, protection? What does that say about this American national security system?
Well, the seat I call is the hardest question of all. It gets so frustrating to, I see, because I truly appreciate some of the 9/11 truth movement, but then it gets so frustrating to see all these different factions, and I have no idea how many of them are actually set up to be, discrediting factor in there. I mean, you get people who, it's just only about a year ago I realized what in the world was this LIHOP, MIHOP, and people coming and saying, oh, you subscribe to whatever hop, and then this is the other hop. And that's the thing, because what I try to tell people, okay, is that you take all the stuff with the gag orders and what I know, you put together, you have written on this topic, okay? And your book also relies on heavily documented, sourced, right, information. You put together with what happened with, let's say, Colleen Rowley, okay? It's not a huge incident, but you take that, put it together with Robert Wright, Agent Wright in Chicago. You get this thing that we still, it's so convoluted with the Able Danger. You bring all the stuff together and you look and say, it has nothing to do what we are being told about who did 9/11 and why and how we didn't know, or the fact that we didn't know. Now, it's this thing that they're talking about, LIHOP and MIHOP and all this, I would say, confusing versions and the theories and hypotheses that they're putting forth, I think that actually ends up taking away from the macro picture. Because to say this thing of what make it happen, then you have to look at a lot of people that had to be in it with it, okay? if you ask my personal opinion, this is not an expert opinion, I would say, no, the people, like on the from the top layer, second or third year, they did not make anything happen.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, the top people, maybe the top layer, there are indications and so much evidence that they may have let it happen, even afterwards, okay? If you see, with Yasin Al-Qadi, they had, and this is not under only Turkish division, because one of the things that people don't know about Yasin Al-Qadi, supposedly he escaped and he got out of the United States. The first place he went for a while was Albania. Hmm. But immediately after that, he went to Turkey.
Yeah.
Okay? And a lot of his banking and operations are all placed in Turkey. Again, you're coming to this Turkey, NATO ally Turkey. Is it some ally that is backstabbing? Goes, absolutely not. It's the other way around. It's the other way around. Turkey is serving the orders and the wishes, and they carry out with the manual and the recipes of what they are given by their bosses, the NATO, US, UK bosses.
Yeah.
So you look at Qadi, ends up in Turkey. All these different bin Ladens and all these people from Saudi Arabia that were taken out. Did FBI agents in the counterterrorism divisions, at least the ones in Washington field office, were they fuming? Did they want to question these people? Absolutely. Who are these? Somebody says, no, you can't question these people. Hmm. And why? I mean, you can't go and say, here are these people. Then you say, no, you can't investigate these people. Then you look at all the other mysterious things. We are not capturing anyone that we can prove has any relation to 9/11. And the ones we say they are either dead, or we make sure they are killed before they are out in the court.
Hmm.
I mean, you put all this stuff together and then say, okay, now look at this and start looking at it from this macro perspective. That is productive. That is getting us close to all these unanswered and questions about 9/11 that should lead us to a path that says, stand up, rise, and demand the further truth, but also justice based on that truth, which I don't think is going to happen. We are sitting here 40 years later, and we still don't have answers on Kennedy's assassination, for God's sake, okay?
Hmm.
And it's every day, and it's pessimistic, I know, but it looks more and more like this is going to be another one of those chapters in U.S. histories. When they come and they give you this official stories, and it, even later throughout the years, when bits and pieces of information comes out, it's either too late because people have given up, nobody listens, the media blacks it out, and it just goes nowhere. And you end up with this cult of people who say, here are all these facts. And that's what happens. We end up being this cult.
Absolutely. I mean, what I think is really powerful, though, about what you have done, And the information that you're presenting, is that, I mean, one, you don't get involved in all of that kind of theoretical speculation. But most importantly, what I think is interesting is that the stuff that you're talking about gives us a glimpse into a very different, almost parallel universe.
And many thanks to Dean Puckett, Sibel Edmonds and Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed for that production, with which we conclude this look at the parallel universes that lie underneath the well-managed fronts presented by the commercially controlled media. This show and all previous episodes are available for download from the Unwelcome Guests archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. If you have ideas for the show, or you hear material that you think is worthy of it, do get in touch. You can contact me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net.